Physics World.
Hello and welcome to the Physics World weekly podcast. I'm Michael Banks, news editor of Physics World magazine. And today I'm joined by my colleagues Hamish Johnson and Anna Deming to talk about all things Nobel. That's right, it's Nobel Prize Week. And this edition of the podcast is devoted to the Nobel Prize for Physics, which was awarded on Tuesday to James Peebles, Michelle Mayer, and Didier Queloz for their work on the early universe and our place in it. Also in the show, we'll chew the fat over the chemistry prize that was awarded to the pioneers behind lithium-ion batteries, a technology that is now ubiquitous in modern life. And finally, we'll reveal the results of a couple of polls about our favourite Nobel Prizes. But first, I'm joined by Hamish to shed some light on this year's Physics Prize.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Hamish. Which saw Peebles receive half the prize for his theoretical discoveries in physical cosmology, while Mayer and Queloz shared the other half for the discovery of an exoplanet orbiting a solar-type star. So Hamish, let's start with Peebles' work on the early universe. Given that Peebles has contributed so much to cosmology over the past 50 years, this seems somewhat like a life achievement award. So what are some of his contributions?
Yeah, I think it definitely is a lifetime achievement award. You know, he's really done a lot of the legwork on, you know, understanding the universe, where it came from, how it's evolving, and where it's going in the future. I think the first sort of major piece of work that he did was on the cosmic microwave background. Now, this is radiation that was created a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang.
And this is like our first picture of the universe.
That's right. It's the first light that we can actually see after the Big Bang. And incredibly, that light is still around. It permeates the universe. And before people really even began to do precision measurements on this background radiation, Peebles predicted properties of it based on how the Big Bang occurred and what happened after the Big Bang. So a lot of our knowledge of the early universe comes down to his sort of profound insights into the cosmic microwave background. And then, of course, as technology improved, astronomers were able to make more and more precise measurements of the cosmic microwave background. And that, you know, revealed lots of things about the universe, about how matter, sort of clumped together to form galaxies and galaxy clusters. So really, Peebles' contribution to our understanding of the evolution of the universe is very profound. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was a kind of one of the main developers of the cosmological model of the universe, like you say. And this is kind of known as the Lambda CDM model. So can you say something about that, what that is?
Yeah, the Lambda CDM model. Peebles was involved both in the Lambda bit and the CDM bit. So CDM is cold dark matter. And that's cold dark matter is a hypothetical substance that essentially permeates the universe. And its gravitational properties define large-scale structure in the universe. So, you know, we think of a galaxy as being stars that are made of gas and there's some dust in there, but really most of a galaxy is cold dark matter. And and Peebles and some other people in the 1980s sort of defined the properties of cold dark matter. It's called cold because it sort of moves around very slowly. They defined the properties of this cold dark matter, and they showed that if you assume that, then you can explain the structure of the universe. And the other thing, the lambda, that refers to the cosmological constant, which is something that Albert Einstein actually introduced.
And then dropped.
Exactly, yeah, he dropped it. And this has to do with sort of the energy, the sort of inherent or zero point energy of the universe. And In the 80s, again, Peebles and others started looking at the cosmological constant as a way of trying to understand how the universe has expanded since the Big Bang. And then there was a huge breakthrough when some researchers made very, very accurate measurements on the expansion of the universe and discovered that it's actually accelerating, which was a huge surprise. Because, of course, you know, after the Big Bang, you would expect either the universe to continue expanding or perhaps even fall back on its own gravity. But it was discovered that that the opposite was happening. And so this brought back the idea of the cosmological constant, this energy, which is subsequently called dark energy, driving the expansion of the universe. And so that's the lambda CDM model. And that you can think of that as sort of the standard model of cosmology at the moment. You know, it's a bit like the standard model of particle physics. It's the best model that we have to describe the evolution of the universe. And yeah, so Peebles was at the forefront of developing that as well.
And of course, there are still kind of a lot of unanswered questions at the moment in terms of what exactly is dark matter. And the same for even dark energy as well. Maybe you could say a few words about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the incredible thing about this lambda CDM model is that it's, well, in almost entirely reliant on dark matter and dark energy, which are two things that we have absolutely no clue as to what they are. You know, for example, physicists have spent decades actually trying to detect dark matter, building huge detectors underground, you know, trying to detect it as it passes through the Earth. And that has been unsuccessful. I mean, we've got lots of evidence for dark matter from, you know, sort of astronomical measurements and cosmological measurements. But, you know, we've never actually caught a dark matter particle and said, here it is. And, you know, the same goes for dark energy as well. You know, there's huge inconsistencies in you know, what dark energy could be, so that is a huge mystery as well. So yeah, I mean, Peebles, you know, he certainly pulled things together, pulled the evidence together into a theory, but of course that theory has some profound mysteries in it as well. Yeah, so yeah, it was a great prize, and I should say, if I can, in my capacity as a Canadian, that you know, we're very chuffed back home. This is 2 years in a row for a Canadian winning the Nobel Prize. Last year it was Donna Strickland at the University of Waterloo, and this year it's James Peebles, who was born in Winnipeg in Manitoba, which is sort of right smack dab in the middle of the country. But he's been at Princeton University in New Jersey for a very long time. But he was certainly born and raised and educated in Canada. So two in a row for Canada.
Two in a row, that's right. Yeah.
I'm sure we'll make it three in a row next year. Yeah.
I mean, for me, one of the most striking aspects of this award for Peebles is that he actually made some of these predictions before the actual first CMB picture was actually taken, which was taken around the 1960s by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, who they actually shared the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1978. So I guess that leads on from kind of nicely comes around then to Peebles Award in terms of him getting it now, because I think he felt that his supervisor was Robert Dickey at the time, and he felt he should have been awarded together with Penzias and Wilson for that discovery as well. So I guess that comes nicely.
And yeah, there's actually a second Nobel Prize associated with Peebles' work, and that's the 2011 prize that went to the leaders of two collaborations who discovered dark energy or discovered the accelerating expansion of the universe. And of course that goes back to Peebles' work on the cosmological constant. So it's all fitting together, I suppose.
All right, well, now let's turn our attention to the other half of the prize, and that was about the detection of the first exoplanet around a sun-like star. So Hamish, maybe you could enlighten us about how you actually go about detecting a planet that could be tens of light years away.
Well, at the moment, there's two ways of doing it, And the winners of this, the Nobel Prize winners, Mayer and Kalaus, they detected the presence of a planet by watching the wobble of the star that the planet orbits around. And the idea here is that when a planet orbits a star, of course, the star also moves. And if you look at the star from Earth, that movement is essentially a back and forth, in and out wobble. And what these astronomers did is they measured that back and forth motion by looking at the Doppler shift of the light from the star. So when the star moves away from the Earth, I think I've got this right, when the star moves away from the Earth, the frequency of the light will drop. And when the star moves towards the Earth, the frequency of the light will increase. And by looking at this Doppler shift, they managed to show that the star did have a companion. But of course, it was a very odd companion. It was, even though the star, I think, is roughly like the sun, the companion that it had, this first ever exoplanet.
This is called 51 Pegasus B.
That's right, yeah. So that planet is about half the size of Jupiter. So it was half the mass of Jupiter. So it's a gas giant. And that gas giant is orbiting extremely closely to the star. I think it's only about 5% of Earth's orbit. So can you imagine an hour in the solar system? Imagine a huge planet orbiting really close to the sun. You know, it just defied all the, you know, sort of the conventions on how planets form and where they orbit. You know, because of course in the solar system we have gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, etc., but they're quite a ways out. The idea of one being extremely close in, you know, sort of that came as a huge surprise. But of course that helps, because the closer the planet is to the star, the bigger the wobble, and the easier it is to detect. Because what they were looking at is a huge planet in a very close orbit around a star. But yeah, it certainly changed our view of how planetary systems form.
And these measurements, these were just taken by a telescope on the ground. It wasn't any space-based measurements, was it? It was just by using a telescope.
Yeah, I think it was a telescope in the south of France. And I think they had, well, I mean, it's often the case that astronomers will build their own equipment. So they had some equipment that they had especially built to make these sort of measurements. And, you know, they had attached them to this telescope in the south of France. And that's how they made their measurement.
I mean, it's an interesting backstory as well, in that, you know, they did discover the first exoplanet, but there were a few kind of tantalizing hints before that. There was a team in 1988, it was a Canadian-led team, I think, who saw kind of a similar wobble, and that was Gamma Cephei A. And then following on from that, in 1992, there was a couple of researchers who announced that they saw two planets orbiting around a pulsar, but there wasn't quite enough evidence at the time to kind of firmly say, you know, these are actual planets. But it seems like, you know, Mayer and Kalaus were actually the first to come out and say, oh, we found an actual planet. But now, thanks to modern space missions like Kepler, we've actually seen thousands of planets, and even to some extent Earth-like exoplanets are also a commonplace.
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting to look at how things have improved, you know, since that 1995 detection. You know, as you say, we've got thousands of, I think over 4,000 exoplanets now have been detected. We're aware of many systems that have multiple exoplanets. And, you know, it's not just these, you know, not just the low-hanging fruit of huge planets very close to stars. We're starting to see Earth-like exoplanets. We're starting to see exoplanets that are in the habitable zone of mm-hmm. their stars, which means that they could be places where life exists.
And even whole systems of exoplanets around the sun, you know, like say for the solar system, you know, you've got multiple planets, even that we're also seeing.
Exactly, yeah. And amazingly, you know, the telescopes and techniques have developed, you know, over the last 30 years or so, to the point where astronomers can actually do spectroscopic studies of the atmospheres of some exoplanets just by looking at the tiny amount of light that transmits through the you know, sort of disk of the atmosphere of an exoplanet. They can start to tell us something about you know, whether there's what sort of gases are in the atmosphere, etc. So yeah, it's an incredible field, and it's grown so much since you know, the first discovery in 1995, and you know, it's going to be interesting to see what's next. You know, with the next generation of telescopes, what we're going to know about exoplanets.
Mm. That's the interesting thing, though, is whether, you know, with this prize, whether that's going to help future missions. You know, in terms of acquiring funding or, you know, getting onto roadmaps.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's already the, you know, a sort of golden era of exoplanet research. So yeah, this is definitely going to help. And yeah, I think, you know, over the next few years, we're going to get some amazing discoveries, and maybe even, who knows, even see a planet that's exactly like Earth somewhere. That would be, I suppose, that would be sort of a holy grail of exoplanet research.
Okay, thanks, Hamish. And now let's move on to the Chemistry Prize, where I'm joined by Anna Deming. Hello, Anna.
Hi.
So this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry, which is announced the day after the Physics Prize, also had a solid physics angle to it, namely batteries. It was awarded to three researchers, John Goodenough, Stanley Whittingham, and Akira Yoshino, for the development of lithium-ion batteries. So, Anna, take us back to the 1970s when all this work began.
Right. So, it started off with some... the idea was that people had been using lead-acid batteries and alkali batteries, and these were batteries that had their origins back in the 18th century. So, they're 18th century? That's really pushing it. More than 19th century. But it's still quite a long time ago in terms of technologies to think that we're still using the same devices today. So people were getting frustrated by the energy density, and there were other people who were sufficiently frustrated to think that they could do something better. And among them, wonderfully, was Stanley Whittingham, who started to look at lithium, because lithium is the smallest metal element, which means that it can pack a higher density of energy for the mass. So the idea was that you could have lithium ions shuttling around in a battery and have a high energy payload and a high potential difference across the electrodes, but not have a high mass of lithium ion to move around. And it's a great idea. He started off working on it with a sulfide, and it was John Goodenough who came up with the brilliance of introducing an oxide. And he tried a number of materials, and I think it was titanium oxide that worked particularly well.
And was that in the 1970s?
So it wasn't the 70s now. We've got onto the 80s now. We're still working on this thing, but it's getting better and better. It's quite a long story, actually. That was one of the questions asked from the journalists when the award was announced, that it's been a slow journey, but it's brought a huge technological revolution. And what really brought this revolution to the consumer was the commercialization of lithium-ion batteries. And that's where Akira Yoshino comes in, because he was the one who managed to actually commercialize lithium-ion batteries so that you and I can now use them in our devices today.
And he was working in Japan at the time, wasn't he?
Yes.
For an actual company, wasn't it? A commercial company.
Yes, it's Asahi Corporation he works with now. And he's also affiliated with Nagoya.
And one of the key aspects, of course, of these lithium-ion batteries is the rechargeability, in that you can recharge these batteries hundreds of times without degrading. I mean, that's kind of one of the important aspects in terms of the commercialization. So where have these batteries found their way into kind of modern life then?
Everywhere. I mean, I think it's a really exciting Nobel Prize. It's exciting for anybody who uses any kind of technology, because it's allowed us to unplug. And of course, yeah, there were batteries before, but you couldn't recharge them. So in terms of sustainability, it's been a massive revolution. So people interested in sustainable technology, you don't have to keep chucking these things away. Lead acid is not a great thing to be sort of generating in huge amounts anyway.
Yeah.
But so lithium batteries you can recharge, and it's also facilitated all these renewable energies that are starting to infiltrate the energy sector, like solar and wind, because you don't have to rely on it being sunny. You can bank it.
Mm.
And to the point that it has infiltrated not just small devices like pacemakers or phones or whatever, but vehicles. And the impact on vehicles is has quite a large impact in the sort of fossil fuel and carbon dioxide emissions that are causing increasing concern for environmentalists.
And a lot of people have been speculating that this Nobel Prize could have, you know, should have been awarded like years ago. You know, this is like work that's been done in the 70s. And it's been obvious for many, you know, maybe even decades now, that this is actually, you know, a commercial, it's led to commercialization. And that's what kind of the Nobel Committee also likes, in terms of the applications to life, your modern life. You know, is there any kind of any speculation you want to do about why it's taken so long? I mean, Goodenough himself is 97.
I know they certainly dragged their heels a little bit in awarding Goodenough and these scientists for work that was really quite a long time ago. I think in lithium ion batteries are much higher in the public awareness, particularly with the surge of use in electronic vehicles. I know there's still a small amount of the vehicles on the road are electronic, but the idea that you could have electric vehicles and I think it's the potential another pun
no
coming
pun
in there
no pun intended.
It's the potential for electric vehicles to start to become the turn to as opposed to fossil fuels, because lithium ion batteries are getting better and better and better. So they're no longer limited to just powering small devices and things that use only a little bit of energy, but they can power very large devices such as cars. And there's a certain tipping point in how good these batteries are and how much they can infiltrate everyday life and how you can really start to move away from fossil fuels. So I think the role they're playing there for a number of things, for people who like to have their gadgets at the hand, for people who are concerned about the use of fossil fuels and the carbon emissions from them, for people who are just really, really impressed by the technology itself and, you know, how they... Because lithium, it sounds a great idea to use lithium because it's a small metal ion, but it's also the most reactive metal. So I'm talking to the expert here because you were the person championing lithium in our...
That's right, yeah.
And perhaps this is... evidence that you should have won after all, Michael. But actually taming the lithium so that it didn't just explode, you could have a battery that you could put in your pocket and, you know, actually dare to go out in the rain. So these are all factors that come together, and why it's so timely now, I think, is because of the way lithium batteries are broadening out in the way they're being used and the impact that they're having in a lot of people's concerns.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Anna. Right, now I'm joined by Hamish and Anna to talk about a couple of polls we've been running. If you've been keeping a close eye on the website, you would have seen that Physics World editors have been choosing their favourite Nobel Prizes. Those picked range from X-ray scattering to liquid helium and the first Bose-Einstein condensate. To coincide with these inspired selections, we've created a couple of Twitter polls to let readers have the final say. Right then, Hamish, so take us through the results of the first poll that we run.
Right, so the first poll I have to say, in last place was my choice. That's the Kenneth Wilson Nobel Prize 1982 for a universal theory of phase transitions. I was very keen on that, but unfortunately the readers weren't as keen. In second place, a more recent prize, 2014, for the invention of blue LEDs, which of course has led to a revolution in low energy lighting. Then coming in second place is X-ray diffraction, 1915 prize, which went to a father and son technique, a father and son, I was going to say trio, but it's not, it's definitely not a trio. It's a, yeah, yeah.
Duo,
that's it, yeah, yeah.
That was the Braggs, wasn't it?
The Braggs, yeah, yeah. A father and son duo, the Braggs. And then in first place, and I have to say, I can't argue with this at all, is the 2001 prize that went for Bose-Einstein condensates. And yeah, I mean, I don't know about you two, but definitely Bose-Einstein condensates was a huge breakthrough.
Yeah. Really exciting, and something that's still making new advances today.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, I was at the University of Colorado, where two of the winners are based or were based, and I found out that that one of the people who won that prize, Eric Cornell, is actually working on a project. I think they've done it already, to put Bose-Einstein condensates in space. Mm. So you know, it's even beyond. It's out of this world. Bose-Einstein condensates, and of course, you know, there's lots and lots of things that you can do with Bose-Einstein condensates. You can study fundamental physics. You can make very precise detectors to make measurements, and you know, you might even be able to do a bit of quantum computing in space.
Yeah.
So you know, that was a great choice, and it certainly deserves to be top of that poll, definitely.
Right then, Anna. So take us through the second poll.
So joint in third place, we had liquid helium.
That was my choice.
Yeah, that was your hat.
It was honours in 1911.
And that was joint with the climate change Nobel Prize in 2007. And then coming third in, we had Raman scattering, and which was my one, I championed. And first, top of the list, was the neutrino mass. So the first measurement is that the neutrino had a mass.
And just in my capacity as cheerleader for Canada, I point out that that Art MacDonald shared half of that neutrino mass prize for work that was done at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which is far underground, I think in an old nickel mine in Sudbury, Ontario. So yeah, another Canadian prize there. Again, you know, neutrino mass is something that's so fundamental.
Yeah, and I think when the neutrinos came along, there were this random little thing that people were trying to explain other things with, but they didn't. I'm trying to think who it was that said, the idea that something we don't know what is doing we don't know what, we don't know how, doesn't sound a very enlightening theory to me. And yet the theory remains, and it's a neutrino, and now we know what it weighs.
and also, wasn't it, there's another great quote, was it Pauli, who was it who postulated the neutrino? They apologized for it.
Okay.
Because they realized that it was going to be so difficult to actually detect the neutrino that, you know, they sort of said, oh, sorry about that. And of course, it was very difficult. I mean, you have to build these huge detectors underground, you know, very, very difficult. So a very deserved prize. Mm. But I think it's also worth pointing out that in terms of the number of people who have read these articles that we've written about our favorites, Anna, your article on Raman scattering was head and shoulders above the rest of them. The last time I checked, there were, you know, tens of thousands of people who had read that. Why do you think the Raman story is so compelling?
Well, I don't think everybody reading the article was reading it with sympathy and joyful jubilation. I think there were a few people reading it with a little bit of irritation, because there is an element of controversy around Raman scattering. The just to fill everybody in, because I jump in it because I think it's a very exciting development. It was finding a new way of light scattering from samples that often, because it's excited a vibrational mode or something, that you can get a really detailed fingerprint of samples, so you get a lot of information and so on. But the guy, when Raman announced that he'd found this effect, it was, you know, pretty much simultaneous with researchers working in Russia who also discovered the effect. And so if you talk to people in Russia about it, it's not called Raman scattering, it's called combination scattering. And I think a lot of people feel a little bit miffed that the Russian scientists were not also accredited with the Nobel Prize, Mandelstam and so on. I would add that they're not the first people who haven't been had their name all over the research development, and there are a lot of scientific developments that it's brilliant science, but the person whose name on it isn't necessarily the person who did all the work or the majority of the work or whatever like this. And even actually Raman's student, strangely enough, is not credited in the Nobel Prize Award, although he was working a lot. So yeah, I think it's a brilliant development. I think it's very exciting that he was the first non-white Asian scientist to be awarded a Nobel Prize for Science, and I think that's quite exciting. Often the people who get left off are minorities, women and that, who don't necessarily get accredited in the prizes. So, yeah, I don't necessarily say I agree that the accreditation was not spread a little bit more, but I still think it was a very exciting development.
And I think I've got this right. Is Raman possibly the winner of the Nobel Prize for hubris? Because he what did he do? He was so convinced
to win. I mean, no non-white Asian had ever won the Nobel Prize before in science, and yet the discovery was made in 1928, and he was patiently waiting for his phone call from the Nobel Committee and didn't get it. 1929 passed. So by 1930, he was so convinced he would get the award that year, he actually booked his tickets to attend the ceremony before he got told he'd won. So, yeah, certainly a Nobel Prize for hubris.
Very optimistic, then.
That's interesting, Anna, because, you know, it is often the case that research done in Russia or the Soviet Union does tend to be ignored. You know, it's something that we come across occasionally on Physics World. You know, we'll write a news story saying that this Western physicist was the first person to do this. Mm. And, you know, we will sometimes get an email from a Russian scientist or a Ukrainian scientist saying, you know, I think you'll find that this research was done 10 years previously in the Soviet Union. And I don't know if that's because of the Iron Curtain.
Yes,
maybe there wasn't communication.
I suspect that not even just the communication, but the willingness to accredit something to somebody on the other side of the Iron Curtain from this side. I think that politics undoubtedly plays a little bit of a role there. But you're right, there have been a number of developments. There was even a point, I remember when I was a student, that whenever a discovery was made, we would be waiting to find out who had done it before from Russia or somewhere in the Soviet Union, yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned diversity, though, in terms of the Nobel Prizes as well. There was an interview earlier this week with Göran Hansson. He's the Secretary General of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. That interview was in Nature. And he was saying in that interview that the committee, you know, tried to make tweaks to the nomination process to get kind of more women nominated, which apparently has happened. You know, but once again this year, we've basically seen
nine.
Yeah. Men who have been, you know, awarded the prizes. So, you know, maybe, you know, whether that's not working yet, but maybe in the future, you know, that might change and we'll get kind of more diverse winners. I mean, last year, for example, we did get the woman,
Donna Strickland the third woman to win the Nobel Prize for Physics, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Anna and Hamish. Maybe actually finally we could just make some predictions for next year and who we think may be on the way to Stockholm next year then to pick up a Nobel Prize. So, Hamish, do you have any
You know me. I've got a soft spot for the Anerov-Bohm effect and Berry's phase, which is sort of a bizarre quantum mechanical effect that, you know, has very profound implications for our understanding of quantum mechanics. So that would be my prediction. That would be to Bristol's University of Bristol's Michael Berry and Yakir Aronov, who's an Israeli physicist. So you know, fingers crossed. I think that's that would be a great prize.
And you've still got that file to hand of the all the articles on Aronov-Bohm.
Oh yeah, we're prepared. We're definitely prepared. Yeah.
And Anna, have you got any predictions, possible predictions for next year?
No, I think Hamish might have stolen my thunder a little bit, because I do think quantum technologies are reaching the point that perhaps lithium batteries have reached, where there is potential for them to start to pervade mainstream life in a way that needs to be recognised by the Nobel Committee.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a case for kind of quantum information in terms of some of the early pioneering work by Anton Zeilinger and Clauser, there was another name, you know, who did these kind of Bell's inequality tests that kind of paved the way for quantum entanglement. So maybe they'll be ready for next year for that call from Stockholm. I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Hamish Johnson and Anna Deming for joining me on this edition of the podcast that was dedicated to the Nobel Prize. And a special thank you to our producer, Callum Jelf. And remember, if you like what you hear, then you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. We're also available now on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.